Welcome to the Hello Someday podcast, the podcast for busy women who are ready to drink less and live more. I'm Casey McGuire Davidson, ex-red wine girl turned life coach, helping women create lives they love without alcohol. But it wasn't that long ago that I was anxious, overwhelmed, and drinking a bottle of wine a night to unwind. I thought that wine was the glue holding my life together, helping me cope with my kids, my stressful job, and my busy life. I didn't realize that my love affair with drinking was making me more anxious and less able to manage my responsibilities. In this podcast, my goal is to teach you the tried and true secrets of creating and living a life you don't want to escape from. Each week, I'll bring you tools, lessons, and conversations to help you drink less and live more. I'll teach you how to navigate our drinking-obsessed culture without a buzz, how to sit with your emotions when you're lonely or angry, frustrated or overwhelmed, how to self-soothe without a drink, and how to turn the decision to stop drinking from your worst-case scenario to the best decision of your life. I am so glad you're here. Now let's get started. Hey there. I've got some big news for you that I have been not so patiently waiting to tell you about. After 6 months away, my super popular, completely free masterclass is back, and it's better than ever. I've been working on it 4 months, so if you have been struggling to get sober momentum, please go to hellosomedaycoaching.com/class. You can sign up for my free training, 5 secrets to taking a break from drinking, even if you've tried and failed in the past. In this 60-minute masterclass, I am going to share with you all the things you need to stop doing because they're setting you up for self-sabotage and what you need to start doing instead. I am giving you the steps and the mindset shifts that I go through every day with my private coaching clients, and it is completely free. So if you are sober curious, if you've been thinking about taking a break from alcohol, this class is going to set you up for success. I promise you, it is worth your time. So hit pause on this episode, go to hellosomedaycoaching.com/class and save your seat. Today, we are talking about how to protect your mental health while raising a neurodivergent kid and how to do it without drinking to cope with it. My guest today is Dr. Emily King, and she's a child psychologist and a former school psychologist. She spent the last 20 years working with neurodivergent children along with their parents and teachers to build an understanding of how a child's developmental skills, relationships, and perception of safety intersect to create the ideal environment for growth. I know that a lot of my private clients have neurodivergent children, and it is a unique source of stress that they need to cope with. And it also is a reason that they emotionally want to check out and drink to as a way to self-soothe, as a way to take care of themselves, which then causes more difficulty. So I wanted to talk about this today. And Emily is also 2 years alcohol-free, which is amazing. She's a friend of a good friend of mine. So I was excited to connect with her. So Emily, welcome.
Thank you so much for having me, Casey.
Yeah, I'm really excited for you to be here because I always try to have guests who have expertise in something that my clients struggle with, and I also don't have personal experience with. I refer them out, but I know that if my clients struggle with it, so many women listening to this podcast often have similar problems that they're dealing with. And we always try to talk about how to solve for the triggers in your life that make you want to drink without drinking, with healthier coping mechanisms. So let's dive in. Will you tell us a little bit about how you came to this work and experience with this?
Yeah. So I came to this work originally wanting to work with kids in schools. I first wanted to be a teacher. And then when I got into school, I realized that the school psychology thing was a profession that I could make it. I was really interested in how kids learn, really interested in why anxiety can impact our learning. So from college, or my early career in grad school and in internships in schools, I quickly knew that I was fascinated by like all the things that interfere with learning. And that's before I really understood all the things that happen in our emotional regulation that have to be solid before we can even learn, which is in our, you know, our upper cortex, our higher level thinking, our problem solving. We can't access all of that until we're emotionally regulated. So over the course of my career, it's been an evolution because I was a school psychologist before I was a mom. And then I became a mom to two boys. So I have a 16-year-old and a 10-year-old. So over the course of having kids and raising them, of course, as I think every working parent does, you learn so much from your kids. And then even if they're teachers listening or if they're therapists listening, you'll probably resonate with the idea of like, I know all this stuff for my job, yet I seem to not be able to implement it because I'm losing it emotionally when my kid makes me mad or whatever it is. So many things I learned from my kids. And then they both have been diagnosed with different types of neurodivergence over the years and have taught me so many things. And so we relocated when my youngest was three back home to North Carolina from Texas. And so I went into private practice at that point because I had already just fallen in love with working with like pretty complex kids that I wanted to do not just evaluation, which is mainly what school psychologists do, but also consulting with teachers and counseling with parents and then doing specific types of play therapy, mainly with young autistic children, but some with children with ADHD, all the while raising my boys and learning from them and navigating school and navigating my practice and navigating my marriage and, you know, and interests. You know, that's something that we can circle back to, but I will say in the 2 years since I stopped drinking, I have had space and time for my interests, and that's been the biggest gift that I kind of didn't see coming. So I'm really passionate to talk to moms, women about this journey that isn't an intense one. I know this from all the parents I've worked with. I know this from the teachers I've worked with, and you have to remain professional when kids are coming at you with big feelings. Most neurodivergent kids have really big feelings. They have sensitive nervous systems. I like to say it's kind of parenting or teaching on steroids. You've got to use all the same things that you do in other, you know, parenting and teaching situations, but more consistent. You have to be on your game like all the time. And that is completely draining if you're juggling lots of different things.
Yeah, I can imagine how difficult that is. I know that when I was drinking, you know, my kids, when I stopped, they were 2 and 8 and are not neurodivergent, and parenting them regardless with a hangover and bad sleep and not having time for myself in the evenings because I was just, you know, drinking a bottle of wine and watching TV, I don't remember, and all that stuff, is so challenging because you physically don't feel well. And so when you're talking about being on your game and kids coming at you with big feelings, and I know when I have a headache and a hangover, I'm like, everything's too loud. Can we just slow down? I want to be by myself. I can't imagine how much more difficult that is.
Right. And so, you know, the mornings of being tired and having a headache, think about the hustle and bustle of getting your kid out the door in the morning. Autistic children, children with ADHD who struggle to remember all their belongings, they need systems and structure. And it is like you wake up and you hit the ground running. And it's a little bit like having young children longer. You know, your kids just aren't as independent as their peers until they get a little older. And of course, every single autistic child is different. Every single child with ADHD and anxiety is different. But generally speaking, what it feels like is you're supporting them longer than this friend of yours over here with neurotypically developing children who are getting their belongings together, who are sitting and coloring without you having to entertain them, you know, who are doing things more independently sooner. And the risk we run here is this, like, just being so overwhelmed by the end of the day and then repeating the cycle, because we do, as I know you've talked about many times, have this, I deserve a glass of wine, mommy wine culture of like, there's no one that feels like they deserve some sort of relief at 5 o'clock than the mom of a neurodivergent child. But the relief has got to come in different forms. If you do feel that drinking is getting in the way of you sleeping and being your best self for yourself and for your kids.
Yeah. And, you know, the truth is you do deserve relief and you do deserve a reward. It's just that alcohol is like that easy button that gives it to you and then takes it away and makes it so much worse.
Yes. Yes. And that's what I felt. I'm kind of a stubborn learner when it comes to taking care of myself. So it took the pandemic. It took being a mental health professional and my kids being at home learning during the pandemic for me to really notice my patterns. And I was always aware that I could be susceptible to drinking because my dad was an alcoholic. But of course, in all of our minds, we're like, but he's not me. And, you know, we come up with all these ideas of dismissing genetics. But during COVID, the stress, the professional stress was higher. And what I will say a little bit as a tangent about being a therapist during COVID is that the vibe that you get from kids you work with in play therapy or parents you work with in person, that is taken away when you're working online. And I don't think any of us really realized it until we did a lot of telehealth online. But I would do full days of therapy online, and I couldn't work with, I couldn't do play therapy with young autistic children anymore because that's not doable online. So I had pivoted and was doing a lot of parent teaching and parent coaching of helping parents play with their children online. But it was nothing but exhausting because it was hard to get that vibe from people that you get when you work with them in person, which is what makes being a therapist so rewarding and validating. And then we were all in this like chronic stress stuff, right? And then I'm like trying to help my kids who don't have the most excellent attention spans with online learning. So clearly I felt I deserved a beverage on my porch by myself at the end of the day.
Yeah. Yeah.
So that's how I started to notice. Yeah.
And how did you, okay, let's briefly talk about that. So how did you notice that it wasn't serving you or that it was a problem? I assume you tried to cut back and moderate when you first struggled with it, because we all know that you do. And what was the path you took to get support or education or reinforcement when you were stopping?
So I started to notice that I was having a drink on my porch by myself with my book, and it was more often that rather than hanging out with my husband at the end of the day. It seems like we excused so many things during quarantine, and it like didn't, I didn't notice it quite at the beginning. And then it started to impact my sleep is when I was like, I just don't feel good. And then I would have headaches, and I didn't realize how crappy I felt actually until months after I stopped and realized how good I felt. And so I started following a few people who write about this. I'm more of like a quiet observer. I'm not going to go telling everybody I'm thinking about being sober curious. I'm ready to talk about it now, as many people are a few years out, feeling more solid about it. But I had followed a few people on Instagram and were reading. I read several books and I was like, okay, this makes sense. And of course, at that time I was trying to moderate a little bit, which in retrospect, I clearly that, did not work very well. And actually our mutual friend reached out to me because she saw that I was following these authors on Instagram. And as we sober women do, we call each other out and ask very honest questions. And I just remember telling her, like, I don't know what I'm doing. I just know that right now how I'm doing it is not working. So any advice you have for me? And we just started this amazing, you know, texting conversation that was my lifeline in those early days. And I did a lot more research and learning, which is how I like to absorb information. And she was really my community of one for a little while until I got out with, you know, after COVID quarantine was over a little bit more. But I live in the South. Like, I didn't know any sober people. And that's what I think was my biggest barrier, was once I got out of quarantine and we were socializing again, there was this like second layer of like saying that I wasn't going to have a glass of wine at dinner with my girlfriends. And it was really ended up being no big deal, but in my head was so big. So, you know, those are some of the things I remember.
You know, what's funny, you said I live in the South, and I think it's everyone who is a big drinker. I mean, I lived in Seattle. I didn't know a single person who was sober when I was sort of worried about my drinking. I hear from people and they're like, well, Wisconsin, it's a huge drinking culture. That other people are like, God, Boston, you know how people drink.
That is so funny.
Everybody drinks, right? It's our culture. And also, you don't find other people who don't drink until you stop drinking, because you're always fostering drinking events and you hang out with people who drink, and we attract, you know, similar people. Mm-hmm. So I just think that's funny, because every single person,
that is funny.
People are like, well, lawyers, it's a huge drinking culture. And then other people are like, well, I'm in marketing and tech, you know how that is. And then teachers are like, drinking among teachers. And I'm like, seriously, teacher? I just was like, you know, it's crazy.
Yeah. And I think, you know, it's the perfect example of like, we have these things in our mind that we think it's because, fill in the blank, right? So it could be where I live, my profession, my season of life. And even though we may think that, the reality is, if you're coming up with reasons, then there's a reason behind why you think you need a reason.
Right? Oh, yeah. And like, stopping drinking is hard for everyone. I mean, I've coached like 150 women one-on-one, and women will say like, well, I have little kids, and so it's really hard for me to not drink. And then people are like, obviously I've had clients who have neurodivergent kids. I mean, my heart goes out to them, just because having kids by itself is incredibly hard. And we're going to talk about strategies for, you know, additional really difficult situations. But also, people will say, I'm an empty nester, I'm lonely, so I drink because I'm bored. Other people will say, well, my husband drinks, so it's incredibly hard for me to stop. Or I live alone, there's no one to have me accountable, so it's hard for me to stop. So if you're listening to this, just know it's hard for everybody. And you can still do it.
Yep. If we can, you can. That's what I always say.
Yeah. Well, so the first thing I want to talk about, and I want to get into coping mechanisms and mom's mental health and how to do all the various things, dealing with triggers, behavior and anxiety, all that stuff. But to start, when we were talking, you mentioned coping with the grief of the diagnosis and moving from denial to acceptance to celebration of your children. Can you talk about how the grief and the denial sort of impacts you and what to do about that?
Yeah. So I think that some of this is evolving with the normalization of neurodiversity, and honestly, specifically with autism, autistic teens and adults telling their stories, and culture changing to make life just more accessible to people. But, you know, when you have developmental concerns about your child, you many times we go to that dark place immediately. We go to this like all or nothing place of it's going to be terrible. It's that fear of the unknown. I don't know what I'm doing. This feels like a lot of work. I don't know, you know, all the I don't knows. And that's often where pushing back against, well, if I don't want to get my child evaluated, because then I'll know. Well, that is, of course, not going to answer the things. The struggles may still continue. Your child has strengths. We may not know how to tap without that evaluation. So I know it's so hard, but we have to have data to help teachers and therapists best understand how to support children in those early years. I have, you know, given those evaluations. I have watched my own children take those evaluations, been there when another colleague has given me feedback on my own kid. It is an emotional, overwhelming experience because it's so vulnerable to hear about all the things your kid is good at, but also struggles with. My best advice for that phase is just remember those evaluations are a snapshot of your kid's skills at that time. And just try to take it 1 year at a time, because we go down this rabbit hole. Grief sends us down this rabbit hole of, I don't know what's going to happen, so I'm going to imagine the worst case scenario. It's better just to imagine it's a mystery. I don't know what's going to happen yet, and go 1 year at a time, because sometimes that grief will hold us back from even getting our child support in the first place. The next part of this I will say is more about when some families I work with, and then I went through this a little bit myself, I was still grieving on the inside that I knew something was different about my first son. And then, of course, went through all the emotions, knew what I needed to do professionally to get him support and all of those things. But I was far down the road of giving him support before I really fully embraced that this was our journey. I think there was a part of me that was still working so hard for you know, him to be in a regular school and a regular whatever in my head I had defined as regular or normal, all the while knowing that, you know, we got to a certain point where he did need a specialized classroom for a few years. And that was really when my stress absolutely dissipated, because I felt like, okay, this teacher gets him. He is around peers that, you know, he's not feeling different from, you know, it was just this window of opportunity that I didn't know I needed, basically. And it felt like a surrender. Like, I was like, all right, I'm just going to let it go and let all the people tell me what my kid needs, even though it's a professional, I knew it too. So yes, it's that I know it, but I can't feel it thing. And when you allow that surrender to happen of like, okay, 1 year at a time, I'm going to make the best decisions I can for what, you know, these professionals are telling me my child needs now. Over time, what starts happening is you start noticing all these awesome things about your kid that you like previously, they might be reminders of differences, and that may give you a little ping of sadness of like, oh, they're different. They're not doing that in the way when, I mean, many of us call these like quirks in kids, but then as they get older, it's really all about their mood. If your kid is happy, but has some quirks or has some like special interest knowledge, but they are happy, that is what matters. And that's what we all want, right? And so there's so many decisions you have to make along the way, and so many therapies and so many, you know, school meetings and all of those things. But if you can just keep your child's emotional regulation and mood at the forefront, the rest of the stuff will kind of fall into place. And it's really cool to watch what unfolds in your kids. And I will say, this is true for everyone. It's just like what I often think about is like, a family who their child's never struggled. And let's say, I'm totally making this up hypothetical, but let's say the parent really wants them to go to this college and they're very disappointed when the child doesn't get into that college. And that's like the first disappointment that family has felt because everything's always gone so well. It's like that feeling, but way earlier on steroids, you're in a grief cycle because you don't know what's to come for the next 16 years of your child's life. So it's a little bit like that, but getting to that place of celebration is freeing.
This episode is brought to you by BetterHelp.
I don't know about you, but I cannot believe how fast this year is flying by. We're all busy, but one of the most important things you can do to make sure you're on the right path is to carve out some time to celebrate your victories and to notice what you wanted to change but haven't been able to yet. Whether you're navigating sobriety, setting boundaries, or striving to be the best version of yourself, therapy can be a game changer. Therapy is for anyone looking for growth and support. And if you're considering it, why not give BetterHelp a try? It's convenient, it's flexible, and it's entirely online. So take a moment for yourself and visit BetterHelp.com/someday to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/someday. Oh my gosh. Can we talk about perimenopause, menopause, and postmenopause for a minute? I am 48, so if you're going through it, I'm right there with you. I mean, hot flashes and night sweats, racing thoughts, the low moods, the poor sleep, it is not cool. And that's why I was really excited to find a supplement called Hormone Harmony by Happy Mammoth. It contains science-backed herbal extracts called adaptogens. They help the body adapt to any stressors like those super fun hormonal changes. It helps reduce menopause symptoms head-on. And if you're interested in trying it, you can use the code HELLO for 15% off your first order. Women cannot stop raving about it on social media, but the biggest benefit is the simplest, feeling like yourself again. So if you're going through this, like I'm going through this, for a limited time, you can get 15% off your first order at happymammoth.com with promo code HELLO. That's happy, MAMMOTH.com. And use promo code HELLO for 15% off your first order. Yeah. And you mentioned this. I've heard this from other people as well. There is just this sadness between, and the idea of like, this isn't fair between the child you thought you would have and the life you thought they would have and the things you thought you would enjoy with them. And the reality is they're also like looking at other parents who aren't struggling with the same things you are and being like, why me? This isn't fair. Why can't this be easy in that way?
Yeah. So the story that this reminds me of is I was in the thick of it when my son was in kindergarten. And he was too overwhelmed to interact really with any child socially. We were struggling to get him just to be, appropriate and safe with teachers at school at that time. And I was on a field trip. So I'm kind of milling around, honestly, by myself because I don't have any like friend moms because my child at that point didn't have any friends. Yeah. And I overheard this group of moms complaining about their children not being placed in the same class for first grade because they wanted to be with their friends. And that is valid for that child's experience, not discounting that at all. But my emotional experience at that time was just like gut punched. Like, I wish my kid had friends to miss, right? So it's this feeling, it's just an overwhelming feeling of sadness every now and then because you're sad for your kid. But I will say the sadness we feel as parents is through our lens. I was a very social, friendly kid. I love my friends. And the kid I'm talking about right now, who's a teenager, is totally happy with family and maybe one or two acquaintances that have similar interests. Like, we do not have the same social needs at all. So we have to remember, like, we are filtering what we're worried about through our own experience. And then the other thing to remember is, like, I don't know why we think we like deserve to have like the kid we thought up in our head. Like, none of us get like the kid we thought of in our head. We just get what we get, right?
Yeah.
And we move forward figuring out how we can be the best adult we can be for that kid.
Yeah. And when you were talking about teachers, I mean, I of course have a different experience, but one of the things that I think we all want is we just want people to love and appreciate our kids. Like when someone tells me, oh, I noticed your child and he's so sweet. Like he, you know, my son, like one of the comments we always get is from the women who work in the cafeteria at school, that he's the one who it's always like mentioning them by name, asking how they are, helping to move the chairs afterwards. And like, that's who he is. But the fact, I mean, he is not the smartest, not smartest. He's very smart. You know what I'm saying? Other kids achieve more. They test better. They do X, Y, Z. And so when someone notices how sweet and kind and gentle your child is, you're like, oh, thank you. Right? Because mm-hmm. then they're emailing you like, and their binder was a friggin' disaster and, you know, didn't bring the right thing to class. But, you know, I mean, I think it's different, but you just want someone to love your child, not to criticize them.
Right. And I'll throw in a strategy here that this is reminding me of as we're talking. So all of those things that educators notice, they're all relative, right? So one kid remembering to turn in their homework is like monumental, call home with the good news. Whereas another kid turning in their homework is like not news at all. That would have been me as a student, you know, like not news at all. Emily turned in her homework. She does that every day. So I think that when we're thinking about our teachers, understanding our kids, communicate with your teachers of like, if my child tolerates going into the bathroom when other kids are in the bathroom at school, that is a huge deal because they've never done that before. Or whatever the thing is that your kid has never done before that teachers may think is whatever, because it's every kid does that, or they may think it's kind of a quote unquote normal thing for that age to do. It could be a big deal for your kid. So communicate all those things so that your teacher is on the lookout for these moments and they can let you know what they see.
Yeah. Well, so let's talk about coping strategies at different ages. And I can assume getting help, getting understanding, realizing other parents are going through this is huge. But what are your tips, whether someone's dealing with a child who's very young or in elementary school or middle school, or whatever you can teach us?
So if your child is young, like under 5, like preschool age, and you're concerned about ADHD or autism or anxiety, usually what we're seeing around those ages is sensory processing differences, language differences that would be making sure you're seen by an occupational therapist or a speech language pathologist to start. Exposure to preschool is great if you can do it, just because your preschool teacher will be able to give you feedback on how they transition, how they do in a group, how they follow along. Really, preschool is about kind of learning to do school. And if there are going to be some emotional regulation differences or some sensitivity to noise or any type of attention weaknesses, you'll start to see them in preschool. And that teacher can help you notice those things. And exposure, of course, is great. For some children, we absolutely can diagnose autism as early as 18 months. For pediatricians, like developmental pediatricians, psychologists who have seen a lot of autistic children, if it's a more severe presentation, like that child is not talking, that child is spinning and flapping, has a lot of self-stem behaviors, it can be more obvious in those young ages. For some kids with a milder presentation of autism, it can possibly not be diagnosed till school age or even middle school. We know so much now. There's some, you know, young adults and even parents that are getting diagnosed, and that's just because we're learning more about it, not because it wasn't there when they were younger. So as they're going into school age, this is when we start to notice ADHD meeting kind of a diagnostic threshold. So all preschoolers are active and impulsive and egocentric, and they're bumping into each other and all the things. But once they get to like 6, 7 years old, yes, they do still need to be playing in kindergarten. So I'm always an advocate for that. But once they're like 6, 7, 8 years old, they should be settling into being able to sit and listen, sit and do some work. They, of course, still need lots of movement. So if you have a highly energetic kid, if you have a highly emotional kid, that sometimes is also this anxiety ADHD mix to look out for. These are kind of the kids where you're like, I don't know how to soothe them. They're upset about things. They're talking negative about themselves. You know, lots of families will start with a therapist, and then we want to usually loop in a psychologist or the school psychologist to evaluate kind of what's going on. So all those things kind of converge with, of course, academics and social. And anytime you have a child who's starting to do that negative self-talk or is noticing that they're different or they're not as good as their peers, we want to get on top of figuring out what it is actually that they need support with and helping them understand you're not a quote unquote bad kid. This is ADHD and you need supports in these areas, and then finding all the things they are good at and making sure they know those things too.
Yeah. Yeah. And so how do people go about finding that diagnosis or that support if they suspect something's going on?
Mm-hmm. For very young children under 5, you can start with your pediatrician. There is a range of what happens after that, depending on where you live and the resources where you are. At age 3, school psychologists can, and different districts and states do it in different ways. But at age 3, kids can be evaluated through the public schools for free, even if they're coming into private preschools.
Not even in school at that age, right?
Mm-hmm. So the law starts at age 3 that you can be evaluated and receive developmental services. And the idea there is that you're preparing them for schooling, which is in America, we have public access to schooling. So at age 3, you can access those services. You would talk to your pediatrician or your local elementary school to figure out what that would be. There's usually like in our district, there's a preschool services office for the whole county where they would go. And then, of course, you could go through private practice. So speech language pathologists, occupational therapists, and child psychologists have private practices that provide evaluation. And the difference is just you have a little bit more. Sometimes you can get in faster with the private services. Sometimes they're covered by insurance. Sometimes they're not. Sometimes it's a person who's doing the evaluation and then will continue to see your child for therapy. So sometimes it's a relationship you really want to have with that therapist. But there are public and private options for those things. And it's just always good to get as much information as you can. And then your child will need to be reevaluated. Best practices is every 3 years, just because, you know, a 5-year-old is very different from an 8-year-old. And then you can't really plan middle school support on testing from an 8-year-old. So we want to do the retesting again. So often that's what I see is every 3 years to help the school team and the provider team plan the best support. And also from where I am and the consultation I do, it's not just thinking about the support, but also what is this kid into? What kind of activities do they need? Where are we going to find these situations and activities that light them up and help them feel happy and successful?
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Can you talk a little bit about the difference between autism and sort of the range of behavior differences in children with autism versus ADD, ADHD? And by the way, please, please, please jump in when I say the wrong thing. Educate me. Like, I'm not well-versed and I don't want to say the wrong thing, insult anyone. You know what I mean? Like, just use things that are outdated.
Yeah, I think we're in a language evolution, and we're kind of always in a language evolution when it comes to any type of marginalized group that feels like other people are speaking for them. It ends up happening. But
by the way, even in the world of alcohol-free, sober, curious, people who struggle with alcohol use disorder, substance use disorder, same thing, right? There is an evolution of language as people become more educated that is less stigmatized and derogatory. So I want to use.
So right jumping off from there, in the DSM, where the manual that we use in the medical model, it is called autism spectrum disorder. I never even use the word disorder in my practice because I don't really feel it's a disorder. I feel it is a different wiring of the brain. So many autistic teens and young adults prefer person first language, which is, autistic person. I'm an autistic person. They feel like they can't, I'm sorry, I just said it backwards. Disability first language, autistic person. And then where I was trained on person first language, like a person with, which many people with ADHD feel like ADHD is just like, I'm a person with ADHD. So it varies, but generally speaking, disability first language is what autistic people are preferring. That said, if an autistic person prefers something different, I'm just going to do what they prefer. So it's all about when I'm working with parents, I will say all these words in lots of different ways and then let them know at some point when your child learns about their brain and the words we use to describe their brain, they will want to identify how it's a little bit like gender and self-expression and how they wear their hair. Like, how do you want to identify your disability? And so it's evolving, but I just encourage everyone to stay open and listen to your kids and to any other autistic individuals about that. So back to your question about kind of the differences in behavior. So autistic brains tend to be very concrete and black and white and have very literal thinking, but all of that usually leans into some extensive strengths and literal patterns. So many, and again, there are exceptions to all of this, but there are many kids and teens that will have, and all young kids are concrete, but when kids kind of shift over to being more abstract, and this usually happens around third and fourth grade, where we shift into like reading comprehension to find the meaning behind the story, or we're doing fractions and we're thinking about wholes and parts rather than just like arithmetic. So fourth grade is sometimes where our rote thinkers or our literal thinkers can start struggling in school. But there's also this overwhelming sensitivity to sensory processing and anxiety that's happening. And you don't have to be autistic to have sensory processing differences. Many kids with ADHD also have sensory processing differences. ADHD kids who are sensory seekers are the really active ones that are going to like run and crash and jump and climb. And like, you know, if this is your kid, because you're like scared, you're going to be hurt like all the time.
You're terrified all the time.
Yeah. And then there's sensory avoiders who often this is a tactile defensiveness, like they don't like to touch sand or Play-Doh, and they don't like how their clothes feel. And they sometimes have food sensitivities with the textures of food and can have feeding issues that are hard. And then I will mention interoception here just because if anyone has never heard of it. So we actually have 8 senses. We have our 5 senses that we know of, and then we have proprioceptive and vestibular and interoceptive. So it's our balance and also the pressure we feel on our body. But interoceptive is our internal body system. So feeling hungry, having to go to the bathroom, feeling hot, feeling hurt. Like these are all things that are usually harder for autistic brains to register in a sensory processing way. So many of these kids can be hard to toilet train. They may have a high pain tolerance because their brain is not registering their pain, or they may be very sensitive to pain. It can go either way. That said, the cornerstone of autism really is the social communication weakness. So you really do have to have a clinician that can tease this out if you feel like your child is anxious, has social weaknesses, and is inattentive. We really need to have an evaluation to figure out what's what. Because sometimes kids will look very, you know, shy and not social, but then they're very social when they're not anxious. And that wouldn't be autism, that would be anxiety. Or a child may have really big upset behaviors, but it's always, you know, it seems to always be because they need something rigidly to be done in the way that their brain is thinking about it. And that could align more with autism. So that's why evaluations are really helpful. And then the therapy that can sometimes come after that and helping your child. And honestly, the therapy is not because a child is autistic or because a child has ADHD. The therapies and parent consultation is about helping your child connect and play and feel less anxious, whatever the presentation is. And then for ADHD, it's often lots of strategies with the parents, with the kid, with the teacher, of basically externalizing their frontal lobe, which is where all of our executive functioning is, with like systems, so that they're not forgetting things and they can learn a system to help them.
When I was drinking, I used alcohol to calm my mind, to relieve anxiety, and to sleep well at the end of a busy day. I didn't know that alcohol actually spiked my stress hormone, increased anxiety, and as little as one glass of wine a night reduced my sleep quality by 24%. I was really excited to find Tenasi, a better way to find calm, rest, relief, and to reduce inflammation. Tenasi creates the highest quality, scientifically validated CBD and hemp extract products. Tenasi's formula includes a unique combination of CBD and CBDA in every dose, which is 2 times more effective than just CBD alone. So if you want to create a sense of calm, to calm your mind, to relax before bed for a great night of sleep, try Tenasi. Tenasi's being really generous with our listeners. You can go to tenasi.com and use code HELLO to get 25% off at checkout right now. That's TANASI.com. to get 25% off your first order with the promo code HELLO, and get ready to sleep well.
Yeah. And I'm sort of jumping all over the place as I'm learning, but I did an episode interviewing someone on ADHD, ADD, and you can tell me what the difference between those are and what the right term is. But I learned in that one that people with ADHD are 50% of them struggle with some sort of substance use, and they're 5 times more likely than the general mm-hmm. population to struggle with that due to all these things, all these reasons, but also like a deficit of dopamine. Do you see that too at all? I mean, not the substance use, because you deal with children, but in terms of dopamine and the way they ask, because also a lot of women, I think typically mm-hmm. men were diagnosed with it. A lot of women that I'm working with are being diagnosed later in life and have sort of used alcohol as a coping mechanism.
Yes. So both with autism and ADHD, our diagnostic criteria are heavily based on, in my opinion, male presentations of those brain differences. And we don't have enough research on girls and women. So for ADHD, ADD is what we called it in the 90s. The reason why the new term hasn't really stuck is because it doesn't make a whole lot of sense. But we call it all ADHD now, but there are 3 types. There's ADHD hyperactive impulsive type. There's ADHD inattentive type. So you're basically, that's ADD. So you're basically saying the hyperactive word is in there, yet we're saying inattentive type. And then the 3rd kind is combined type. So you have your inattentive, your impulsive, and your hyperactive. So often what happens, and we, you know, I was 20 years ago, I was trained that girls fly under the radar. You have to look closely. And we didn't use the word masking back then. It was a more of this like slip through the cracks and fly under the radar terminology. But when what would usually happen is, girls that I see with a lot of anxiety, we need to make sure that there's not a deficit in attention or learning, because if you're in an environment that's higher in expectation than the skills you have, not necessarily the intelligence or the academic skills, but the attention skills, that's going to be stressful and you're going to feel embarrassed that you don't know how to answer that question, or you totally missed what the teacher said, or you don't have your belongings. You know, that's what I hear more of in girls and women. And you're absolutely right. More women in our generation are getting diagnosed with ADHD and even autism, not because they didn't have it when they were little, but because they were missed or they were labeled as something else. They were labeled as anxious. They were labeled as, you know, honestly, a people pleaser or a perfectionist, which is also anxiety. But if you work really hard to do the right thing and it's exhausting, that is could be a recipe for underneath it, there could be some inattention. But I think too, when I because I work with kids, I can't totally answer the question on like adult dopamine and ADHD. However, what reminds me of is the sensory seeking, the impulse control. And what I'm reminded of too is Jess Leahy's book, Addiction Inoculation, talks about, talks about this a little bit of when we are raising really active sensory seeking kids, it's important that we have them in environments that when, because they like sports or like music where they need a lot of input and action, and that we're putting them in environments where that's safe action.
No, that's really interesting. So how do you set your child up for success? Because I've had some clients who modify, you know, a bunch of their friends are getting their kids together and they're like, okay, I can't put my kid in that environment, or I can't put my kid in that environment for long, that, you know, is all over the place. How do you, once you recognize, or when you're working with parents, once they recognize what's going on with their kids, what steps do they need to take to make sure their kids are in an environment that sort of feels safe to them?
The first thing to recognize is that not all scenes are going to be your scene. And I think that as women, moms, social circles we're in, I think we all go through this. We have like our mom friends, and then we have children, and our children may not be friends. So our friendships sometimes shift. So raising a child with different skills is similar to that, but for different reasons. You got to find your people that understand that you may not bring your kid to this outing because it's not fun for them, or you may come for 30 minutes and that is tops what their attention span or, you know, energy level can handle, or what you can handle in supporting them in that environment. So that's the plan. So just telling your friends that, hey, I'm coming for 30 minutes because this right now is our window of socializing. You have to realize, though, that that's going to get better. And I think that's where sometimes we get stuck of like, I am sad that my kid can't do the things like others. So I'm just going to push it and try to do it anyway. And then that can sometimes blow up in our face and our kid is stressed and we're stressed and no one had a good time. Or you can go the other direction and never show up to the things, which also is not going to give your kid exposure. So you've got to find the right type of environment, the right timing for it, and the people in that environment. You can prep them for what your kid needs, what your kid's into. And I always suggest prepping, if there's an older kid in that situation, prepping the older kid, because there's so many helpful older kids, or even same age neurotypical kids. They're so open if we just explain it to them. Like, hey, my kid loves playing with balls and only balls, and he will play with balls the whole time. And if he doesn't have a ball, it's going to go south. So will you play with him the whole time? And they're probably like, sure. You know, kids are so resilient. So, you know, thinking outside the box on some of those things.
Yeah. And does it get harder as kids get older? We talked about young kids, but I know as kids get older, some of them, you know, can be mean, can be ostracize kids. And that's really hard as well. How do you deal with that? I mean, because you talked about just explaining it to them about the ball, and kids are so caring, especially if children might be younger than them. But once they're their age, does that shift?
I'm so glad you asked this question. So in my work, with all ages. I usually see this kind of too cool for school developmental shift in neurotypical kids around age 11, around like late fifth grade, where they feel uncomfortable with differences. And so for those listening who are like, well, my kids are neurotypical, how can I help them be accepting peers? I could talk for days about this, because once my kids and other neurodivergent kids get to a certain age where, you know, they're maybe standing out a little bit more, they may be noticed as like, gosh, they're still upset about this. And they, most kids around them are not getting upset about this, or whatever it is. It's the other kids, the environment they're in, that could make a huge difference. So you can coach your neurotypical kids on noticing differences that aren't obvious. So I think all of us would hope that, like, if our kid saw someone in a wheelchair, there would help them, or saw someone who was vision impaired with a walking stick, would know what to do and be kind. What I'm talking about, though, is a kid with big explosive emotions, or a kid that, you know, has to quit a game because they can't handle it. You know, we need to normalize some of these things for our kids and say, hey, what I usually coach kids on is they're having a hard time. Let's give them some space. And you can go ask their grown-up if you want to know how you can help. And so a lot of times kids are scared, kids are uncomfortable, they don't know what to do. And many times that's because we accidentally, inadvertently model, oh, I don't know what to do. That kid looks explosive. But what we can do is give that child space and ask their grown up, whoever is with them, what would be helpful right now? Like, if you see a kid meltdown in Target, it's so helpful to just connect with that parent. And with a young child, how many of us have looked at another parent in Target of a toddler screaming and be like, I've been there, I got you.
Oh my God.
But a 10-year-old melting down in Target, it takes a parent who has been there and understands that to just lean down and be like, do you need anything? Can I do anything for you? And usually the answer is no, just got to sit here and wait it out. But sometimes that can be helpful, and to coach your kids on that so that they're not feeling like that kid is different. Because when kids hold it in and they feel different, there's this like crowd mentality in middle school where they think it's okay to joke around about differences, and it's not. I think that we've evolved in terms of better social interactions with kids with intellectual disabilities and kids with physical disabilities. But this area of this child is struggling in school or struggling to control emotions or is joining the group, but, you know, has some awkward motor skills or something like that. Those, you know, appearing to be milder presentations, even though they're very hard for that child. I think we have more to work on for that.
Do you ever find that with teachers who are perhaps not as kind or patient or educated as maybe they should be or could be? Meaning they're like, your kid acts out, they just need to go sit in a corner. I can't deal with this. They're disruptive.
Sometimes, yes. And this is two things to say about that. Our teaching programs, this is why I do so much professional development for teachers. Our teaching programs, I think at baseline across the country and maybe the world, are getting outdated. This stuff changes so fast. And so I learn stuff from my clients in real time that I can share with teachers, and I do, and share stories and professional development. And it's all new information for them, and they're sponges to learn that stuff, but they didn't get it in grad school, right? The other thing I'll say, so there's this like divide between like their training and what's happening now. The other thing I'll say is just, this is my mission in the world. If a teacher is also a parent that's neurodivergent, they get it. And there's this sense of like a parent knowing like, oh, we got a teacher this year and they get it. Like, what that means is like, they understand that my kid's not being bad. They understand that they're overwhelmed, upset. They're in a stress response. They can't do it. Not that they won't do it. And so we have some work to do in helping everyone understand that most of the time it actually is a can't. Sometimes it is a won't. Sometimes it's like a, he made me mad, so I'm going to knock on over his tower on purpose. Sometimes it is that. And once we figure it out, we'll support that too. But most of the time it's an overwhelm and we have to figure out what's going on in the environment that's too much, or with the expectations that's too much. And the old school kind of traditional discipline of stuff, like you did this, so now this is the consequence, that only works if the child knows a better way for next time, which some, I guess, neurotypical kids can like look around and be like, oh yeah, I know what I was supposed to do and I didn't do it. And that would potentially work. But that rarely, if ever, works for neurodivergent kids because they don't know what to do instead. So we have to teach them what to do instead.
Yeah. Yeah. And when you talked about the 10-year-old melting down in Target, I know from myself how, even when my daughter was younger, how difficult that was. The tension between, you know, you and your spouse, the difficulty when they are, you know, sort of being really hard on you emotionally. And we talked about how easy it is for all of us, but especially if you're in that sort of stress response, to turn to alcohol, to numb out, to give yourself some reward, some relief, some quiet between you and the situation. So how can you protect your own mental health, but also find other ways other than drinking to deal with that?
Yeah, this is why I often will say you deserve relief. You know, we often get in this, we often say, I deserve a glass of wine. Well, we have to expand that list of what is relief for us at that time of day. It could be a bath. It could be a walk. The main concern and issue logistically with raising neurodivergent kids is childcare. You have to have another person who understands your kid and who you trust with your kid. So building that village is number one. And so whether that is a specialized babysitter, there are sitters that have training that you can, you know, vet, you know, if your spouse, you and your spouse can tag team, that's of course wonderful. This does get better as kids get older, as it does with all kids, but it does get better. there are also some support groups, I know online for kids who have significant, either intellectual disabilities or significant impairment with genetic disorders and things like that, where they do not become independent. And so that's not what I'm talking about here, but there are supports out there for families who need lifelong respite. So some sort of, you know, schedule where they're getting respite regularly. But for a family who needs to like tag team it, it is about structuring your day and your week. Start to notice your patterns of when you want to tap out and strategically putting things that you love in those moments. And you have to just be on top of scheduling that and aligning it with when you have childcare, when your child is maybe at an activity. And then this is where schedules come in handy with autistic children who love predictability and visuals, which are great for all ADHD and autistic brains for different reasons. One's predictability, but ADHD brains forget a lot that's said verbally. So having it there either digitally or on a whiteboard is huge. And so helping your family know that you are not going to be available for this 30-minute window and it's predictable can be really helpful moving forward. And it's similar to when you had a toddler and you were trying to pee and the only time you were by yourself was when you were peeing. It's like that. It just happens longer into their development. So you need a plan.
So what are some of the things that I know you work with parents that you suggest, like tangible examples, I know help a lot of people. They're like, yep, do something you love for 30 minutes. They're like, I don't even know what that possibly could be.
I would start with taking care of your body, because I truly believe when we take care of our body, then we can start to think about what we like. Like when we are in our house and the thick of it, it is so hard to figure out what you would want to do. But let's say you commit to going on a walk several times a week. And then during that walk where the noise of children, the noise of decisions, like all that noise we have going on mentally is gone, committing to that first. And then it's almost like, for me at least, it was like layer by layer, I started to just notice more of when I felt joy and when I felt fun and trying to expand those windows of time, which we have to prioritize our movement and our sleep first for those to happen, which of course, as we know, gets better when you're not drinking because you sleep so well.
Hi there. If you're listening to this episode and have been trying to take a break from drinking, but keep starting and stopping and starting again, I want to invite you to take a look at my on-demand coaching course, the Sobriety Starter Kit. The Sobriety Starter Kit is an online self-study sober coaching course that will help you quit drinking and build a life you love without alcohol, without white-knuckling it or hating the process. The course includes the exact step-by-step coaching framework I work through with my private coaching clients, but at a much more affordable price than one-on-one coaching. And the Sobriety Starter Kit is ready, waiting, and available to support you anytime you need it. And when it fits into your schedule, you don't need to work your life around group meetings or classes at a specific day or time. This course is not a 30-day challenge or a one-day-at-a-time approach. Instead, it's a step-by-step formula for changing your relationship with alcohol. The course will help you turn the decision to stop drinking from your worst-case scenario to the best decision of your life. You will sleep better and have more energy. You'll look better and feel better. You'll have more patience and less anxiety. And with my approach, you won't feel deprived or isolated in the process. So if you're interested in learning more about all the details, please go to www.sobrietystarterkit.com. You can start at any time, and I would love to see you in the course.
Yeah, absolutely. So what about your marriage or your partner? I can imagine there's tension there, both from like different parenting strategies, or if you're tag teaming, not enough time together, or frustration that, you know, I know my husband and I basically take turns being frustrated. Like if someone is super frustrated, like the other person turns super understanding. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Yeah. So I think at this point, it's always like a well-oiled machine in terms of like, my husband's an engineer. I'm like a feel a writer thinker only when I'm like feeling stuff, and, you know, he's like solving problems. And so if any type of like collaboration or communication about like all the things need to happen, like that's me. And if any of like the fixing and strategic research needs to happen, that's him. But so we've pretty much got those like jobs down, I think, of like roles that we feel like lean into our strengths. But one thing I will say is that, and this is because we've done a lot of parenting work to parent our kids, which you can't really do parenting work without talking about your dynamic, right? So that's been really helpful for us to just increase our communication and be completely honest and be honest sooner. Like, don't walk around thinking about it all day, but ask for example, you know, my husband, someone like, I have to tell him exactly what I think, what I need, just tell him exactly, you know, a lot of men are that way. Because we don't have time for him to figure it out. We don't have time for me to like think about how I'm going to say it. I just say what I need. And then the other thing I will say is as the kids have gotten older, we have figured out like our own social needs and celebrated how those are different. And I think I haven't mentioned this yet, but my two kids have very different social needs. My older son is like the safety patrol and my younger son is the cruise director. And the two of them together are kind of hilarious because one like never wants to break a rule and like thinks everybody's going to get hurt. And the other one is like, the more the merrier, invite the neighborhood over. And so it's like, that's hilarious. So it's very normalized in our family to have different social needs. So my husband and I are very open about that too. I need to go out to dinner with friends more than he does, but he does it sometimes. And we are very open with our kids about like, this is his turn to go out with his people and my turn to go out with my people. Or when it's time to, I mean, we, it is true that we do not get away by ourselves at all as much as other families. And that's just something that we've accepted. We have worked very hard to go on family trips. I blog about this. I write about this in terms of like teaching your neurodivergent kid to travel and how they can grow and learn and do so many cool things when they travel that they don't do at home. Cause I've seen this over and over again with clients and with my kids, but we do a lot of family travel that helps us feel like we're not, you know, stuck in a rut at home.
Yeah. Yeah. No, that makes a lot of sense. What else haven't we talked about that you think would be helpful for someone listening to this who has a neurodivergent kid who needs relief, who needs to take care of themselves without drinking?
I would say I want to leave everyone with some hope and some patience with time, because I don't know about you, but I'm a person that like when I decide I want to do something, I want it to happen yesterday. Yeah. So getting used to like the evolution of like sleeping more and moving more and getting in a workout routine that works for me and all of that has taken 2 years. It has taken 2 years. So, you know, that first year was like me figuring out how to not drink. It was just me not drinking and living my life without drinking. The second year was like, I feel like it was about where there is space now. I'm rested sometimes, not all the time, but sometimes more than I was before. You know, what I've added music back into my life, which I had kind of ignored for the last 20 years of work and family. And that has been a huge bonus to my life, both socially and also just kind of spiritually. So I think just having the patience that just do one next best thing for yourself, and you're building this life into the future and your kids are continuing to grow and they won't continue to do the things they're doing right now. I really had to embrace kind of the mystery of like, I can't wait till I see what this kid's doing when they're 20, because I have no idea. I just like released all those expectations and just take it 1 year at a time. And that's been a blessing.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. How do you celebrate your kid? Like, how do you notice and take joy in who they are?
So my kids get really enthusiastic about one in particular, about his interests, which are quirkier than some. And we just lean into that. We lean into what he loves to do and we plan things around it. We plan trips that I would have never gone on. You know, we try to really help them expand the time and experiences when they feel successful. I feel like those times end up being buffers to the challenging times. And if we have the time and the means to do it, we do it. And so long ago, we let go of the idea of like going on this trip because I wanted to or my husband wanted to. You know, we're just in a season of life where we celebrate their interests and we try to nurture those. And for many, many parents do this, but they're just more common, like traveling for sports or a musical concert or something. But if our kids are into something, we're going all in.
Yeah. No, that's interesting. I was telling you right before that my son was about to get his license, and I was really excited because he plays select baseball, and he had 40 games between June and July last summer. And it took my entire summer. And just personally, my husband's a baseball coach. Watching baseball is not my favorite thing in the world. If I had to go to a game once a month, I'd be thrilled. 40 games in 2 months is a lot. And it is in no way equivalent, but I can imagine, you know, your kid's really into something. You may not love doing it, but you like that your kid is happy and engaged. So you do it anyway, yes. You know?
Yes, it's actually not that different. So the example is my kid loves U.S. history. He loves presidents. I have been to 2 presidential libraries I would have never been to before. Cool. Had my kid not been my kid. And we worked them into travel. Major,
so I was like, that's kind of cool. Yeah.
Yeah.
Almost more interesting than baseball. Just kidding.
Right. So that's the thing. Like they're not us. So they're going to have interests that are theirs. And we're just this vehicle that lets them like explore that interest. And we can provide that and then provide that joy that they feel, whatever the interest is. What is getting in their way is the cultural expectations of, oh, isn't everyone into baseball? That is more common of an interest than U.S. presidents. But yes. At the same time, like, it doesn't matter. Like, whatever people are into is what people are into. And that's how we make the world go round. Like, that's why everything works, is because we're all into something different. And I tell my son all the time, like, I am so glad that you are into this because my brain can't do it. So my son has a really specific high strength in remembering dates. And it's completely normalized in our family that like, if we can't remember where we're going or when we went somewhere, like he knows. So, you know, like, I don't know how we're going to work that into a job one day, but it's just this thing that we have lifted up as a strength, and he loves being able to share that and loves getting feedback from people that like, that's his thing that he loves. Cause he totally knows more in that category than most neurotypical people.
Yeah, no, that's super interesting. As I said, also, I was American history major. And so I was like, actually, that'd be really cool. And don't get me wrong. I love sports. I love watching basketball and soccer and little bit of baseball, but yeah, I was like, oh, American history, presidential libraries. That's super interesting. So it takes all kinds.
So we all have our thing. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I can imagine that one of the most important things that people can do if they're recognizing this in the thick of it, struggling with it, is to get support for their kid and support for themselves and support for their marriage. Tell us about where people can find you. I know you have a lot of resources, both on your website, the work you do, you speak, and also on your social media. So talk to me first about that, and then any other suggestions of resources.
Yeah, the best place to go to find all my resources is my website at learnwithdremily.com. But if you're ready to completely dive in, I do have a very active Substack at learnwithdremily.substack.com, where I have lots of blogs and articles and host monthly parent workshops there. And then I also offer professional development to teachers. So if there are any teachers or administrators listening, you can just contact me through my website for that. But you're right, the community aspect is really important. So I post community threads on Substack where we talk there and share resources with each other, whether it's ideas or just locally in your area, strategies for that. You know, talk to other parents in your kids' schools about where they're going for, you know, therapies or for social groups or activities. Because when kids are young, it's all about, you know, helping them build skills and get used to school and kind of keeping everybody emotionally regulated in the family. And then as they grow up and get interest, you start to figure out what they're into and you start investigating that. So every season is different. And of course, locally, these services are different. So, but talk to other parents, and usually you find those reaching out to teachers or getting connected with other parents in your child's school.
Okay. That is super helpful. I'm going to ask one more question that is probably,
yeah,
I don't totally understand Substack. Can you explain? I know all these people in the alcohol-free world who are starting with Substack and writers, and I don't totally get it. Will you tell me how it works?
Yeah. So Substack is like WordPress and Facebook had a baby. So
okay.
It's a blog platform, but there is a social media feed component. So you can post. So I post my blogs there, but I also can post about a workshop and have links out to somewhere else. I can repost things in my feed that other writers will see. So it's basically, so I think of it as like social media for writers. And then writers are doing a lot of like workshops or sharing other people's writers. And there is a subscription component to it. So there's a understanding that like some of it is free, but then also writers need to get paid for their work. So they're usually subscription levels to everybody's Substack. I love it just because I love to write. I am working on a book. So I'm thinking through other writers on there and what they're writing about. And I spend most Friday mornings reading Substack.
Well, it sounds to me like social media for people who also want to learn about specific topics or are very interested in that.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Yes.
Okay.
It's all blogging and writing. Like there's okay. There are no ads. You can post a video, but it's not like a reel popping into your face.
Yeah.
It's like,
yeah. I've also heard that it's kinder and gentler than a lot of the social media out there.
So far.
Yeah. Fingers crossed, man, right?
I know. Fingers crossed. Don't they all start out kind of gentle?
I know. Well, thank you so much for coming on. I know this conversation is going to help so many people. And I hope that anyone listening to this starts following you and knows that they're not alone and gets the support they need.
Well, thank you so much for having me and letting me talk about this cross-section of mental health and neurodivergence.
Oh, you're so welcome.
It's easy to blame ourselves for our struggles with alcohol. We see people around us being able to control their drinking without any consequences, yet no matter what we try, we can't seem to figure it out for ourselves. My name is Jillian Teets, and I am the host of the Sober Powered Podcast, where I use my biochemistry background to explain the latest research in addiction and help you understand both why you drink the way you do and how to develop the skills and mindset you need to find freedom from alcohol. I discuss topics like why we think about our drinking 24/7, why we have no off switch, and why we crave alcohol. If you're struggling with your drinking or you know someone who is, then I hope that you will check out the Sober Powered Podcast. New episodes every Friday. See you there.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Hello Someday Podcast. If you're interested in learning more about me, the work I do, and access free resources and guides to help you build a life you love without alcohol, please visit HelloSomedayCoaching.com. And I would be so grateful if you would take a few minutes to rate and review this podcast so that more women can find it and join the conversation about drinking less and living more.